of vernacular languages, long before science and technology even began to come abreast of them. Is Tocqueville describing something real? He stood at a place in the evolution of culture where there would be both a continuously new, because incremental, expansion of literacy and learning, and a vast population they had not yet touched. John Keats, briefly Tocqueville's contemporary, was moved by an Elizabethan translation of Homer. "Then I felt like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken." What was it that Keats took from this encounter? What wild surmise! Keats holds such a rarefied place in literature now that it is hard to believe he was once ridiculed as one of the Cockney school of poetry. But his sonnet is expressing that old humanist privilege of being ravished by a book, and of finding that it has a suggestive power far beyond its subject, a potency the affected mind itself might be years in realizing. I talked once with a cab driver who had spent years in prison. He said he had no idea that the world was something he could be interested in. And then he read a book. In the history of the West, for all its achievements, there is also a persisting impatience with the energy and originality of the mind. It can make us very poor servants of purposes that are not our own. A Benthamite panopticon would have radically reduced the varieties of experience that helped to individuate us, in theory producing happiness in factory workers by preventing their having even a glimpse of the fact that there could be more to life. Censorship, lists of prohibited books, restrictions on travel, limits on rights of assembly, all accomplished by more practicable means, some part of the same exclusions, precluding the stimulus of new thought, new things to wonder about. The contemporary assault on the humanities has something of the same objective and would employ similar methods. Workers, a category that seems to subsume us all except the idlest rich, should learn what they need to learn to be competitive in the new economy. All the rest is waste and distraction. Competitive with whom? On what terms? To what end? With anyone whose vigor and good fortune allows them to prosper, apparently. With anyone who has done a clever thing we did not think of first. And will these competitors of ours be left to enjoy the miserable advantage of low wages and compromised health? And is there any particular reason to debase human life in order to produce more, faster, without reference to the worth of the product or to the value of the things sacrificed to its manufacture? Wouldn't most people, given an hour or two to reflect, consider this an intolerably trivial use to be put to for them and their children? Life is brief and fragile, after all. Then what is this new economy, whose demands we must always be ready to fill? We may assume it will be driven by innovation and by what are called market forces, which can be fads or speculation or chicanery. Oh yes, rowdy old capitalism, let it ply its music. Then again, in the all-consuming form proposed for it now, it is a little like those wars I mentioned earlier. It is equally inimical to poetry, eloquence, memory, the beauty of wit, the fires of imagination, the depth of thought. It is equally disinclined to reward gifts that cannot be turned to its uses. The urgency of war or crisis has been brought to bear on our civil institutions, which is to say, on the reserves and resources of civility we have created over many generations. We in America are famous for our endless and costly election seasons. I think they are a good thing, all in all, even though, as an Iowan, I am subjected to the campaigning longer than most of my countrymen. There is a logic in exposing candidates to grueling scrutiny for months at a time. Once one of them is elected, he or she will have more control over public perceptions. But in the adversarial environment of primaries and elections, things are revealed that are highly germane to the question of a candidate's suitability for the presidency, which is certainly the most intense and pressured office in the world. Many of the candidates make themselves ridiculous, providing valuable information to the electorate. The parties grope to discover what is possible, what is needed or desired. Or, notoriously, they offer themselves as agents of certain interests of friendly billionaires, which, we are to believe, align themselves nicely with the public interest. None of this is truer for the fact that it plays out in the press. We have no corner on foolish or mercenary politicians, but we do give ourselves a good long look at them, and weeding takes place. It is regrettable that all the expense in time and money does not buy a more substantive national conversation. Still, we find out what notions and attitudes are lurking in the minds of some of our politicians, and what they hope will have the power to stir some part of the populace. One of our candidates has called for an attack on the university cartel, by which he means our system of public higher education. The phrase is startling, considering that these institutions are, in effect, great city-states, shaped by their regions and histories, largely supported by their alumni, variously specialized around faculties that are attracted by distinctive areas of excellence. Recently, despite their enormous contributions to science and technology, they have been losing the support of many state legislatures, first on the pretext of austerity, and then on the grounds that they were properly understood as burdens on the public rather than as public assets. As state financing fell, tuitions rose, involving many students in burdensome debt. For generations, people had in effect prepaid their children's and grandchildren's tuition and underwritten the quality of their education by paying taxes. Suddenly, the legislatures decided to put the money to other uses, or to cut taxes, and families were obliged to absorb much higher costs. For this, blame has fallen on the universities. And since the new cost of university is weighed against potential earnings, students and families being so burdened, the humanities are under great pressure to justify their existence. As it happens, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has a fine music school, and Rensselaer Polytechnic gives its students prizes for fiction and poetry. These schools might know something about nurturing the technical mind, but there is an impulse behind the recent assaults on great institutions that is historically expressed as social engineering. The ideal worker will not have a head full of poetry, say the neo-Benthamites. It is assumed, of course, that he or she will be potentially omnicompetent in service to the ever-changing needs and demands of the new economy, highly trained, that is, to acquire some undescribed skill set that will be proof against obsolescence. We await particulars. But the object is clear: to create a virtual army out of the general population who will compete successfully against whomever, for whatever, into an endless future at profound cost to themselves. All this differs from military engagement in one great particular. The generals are always assumed to be free to abandon their armies and go over to the other side, if there is profit in it. The United States is in many ways a grand experiment. Let us take Iowa as an example. What would early 19th century settlers on the open prairie do first? Well, one of the first things they did was found a university, which is now about 170 years old. Agriculture became, as it remains, the basis of the state economy. How did the university develop in response to this small agrarian population? It became, as it remains, a thriving and innovative center for the arts, theater, music, painting, and of course creative writing. The medical school and the professional schools are fine as well. The sciences are very strong. But the arts are the signature of the place, and have been for generations. Let us say that these old Iowans did not invest their resources and their youth as wisely as they might have. Or let us say that, the world lying open to them, they had the profound satisfaction of doing what they wanted to do, at a cost to themselves, in mercenary terms, with immeasurable returns in humanist terms. Their university has been a great nurturer of American letters. If Tocqueville was right, it has nurtured a great deal more besides. What are we doing here, we professors of English? Our project is often dismissed as elitist. That word has a new and novel sting in American politics. This is odd, in a period uncharacteristically dominated by political dynasties. Apparently the slur doesn't stick to those who show no sign of education or sophistication, no matter what their pedigree. Be that as it may, there is a fundamental slovenliness in much public discourse that can graft heterogeneous things together around a single word. There is justified alarm about the bizarre concentrations of wealth that have occurred globally, and the tiny fraction of the wealthiest 1% who have wildly disproportionate influence over the lives of the rest of us. They are called the elite. And so are those of us who encourage the kind of thinking that probably does make certain of the young less than ideal recruits to their armies of the employed. If there is a point where the two meanings overlap, it would be in the fact that the teaching we do is what in America we have always called liberal education, education appropriate to free people, very much including those old Iowans who left the university to return to the hamlet or the farm. Now, in a country richer than any they could have imagined, we are endlessly told we must cede that humane freedom to a very uncertain promise of employability. It seems most unlikely that any oligarch foresees this choice as being forced on his or her own children. I note here that these criticisms and pressures are not brought to bear on our private universities, though most or all of them receive government money. Elitism, in its classic sense, is not being attacked, but asserted and defended. If I seem to have conceded an important point in saying that the humanities do not prepare ideal helots, economically speaking, I do not at all mean to imply that they are less than ideal for preparing capable citizens, imaginative and innovative contributors to a full and generous and largely unmonetizable national life. America has known long enough how to be a prosperous country, for all its deviations from the narrow path of economic rationalism. Empirically speaking, these errancies are highly compatible with our flourishing economically, if they are not a cause of it, which is more than we can know. The politicians who attack public higher education as too expensive have made it so for electoral or ideological reasons and could undo the harm with the stroke of a pen. They have created the crisis to which they hope to bring their draconian solutions. Neo-Benthamism stands or falls with our unquestioning subservience to the notion of competition, which really comes down to our dealing with the constant threat on the part of these generals to abandon their armies and, of course, with their demonstrated willingness to act on the threat. Does anyone who cares for such things owe them those great and ancient pleasures of life, poetry, eloquence, memory, the fires of imagination, the depth of thought? Do the pressures created in the larger world deprive us and the world of gifts the Chinese or the Russians would bring to it? We know these cultures have been rich and brilliant in ways that are no longer visible to us, at least. If we do have this effect, is there one thing good about it, for us or for them? If the vastness of the Russian imagination, the elegance of the Chinese eye and hand, were present to us to admire without invidious comparison, of them to us, or us to them, wouldn't the world be richer for us all? If the rise of humanism was a sunrise, then in this present time we are seeing an eclipse. I take it to be merely a transient gloom, because the work of those old scholars and translators and printers, the poets and philosophers they recovered, and the poets and philosophers who came after them, the habit of literacy, and the profound interest in the actual world in the present time, have all taken hold more profoundly than we know. We have not lost them. We have only forgotten what they mean. We have forgotten to understand them for what they are, a spectacular demonstration of the capacities of the human mind, always renewed in our own experience, igniting possibilities no one could have foreseen. Tocqueville may be no more than conventional in speaking of them as gifts which heaven shares out by chance, and it may be that the convention of ascribing our gifts to a divine source, a convention that comes down from the earliest humanists, gave him and them a language able to capture something our truncated philosophies cannot accommodate. I never hear the phrase human grandeur, though many a planet has swum into my ken, though I know the rings of Saturn in detail. Step back and consider that more or less hidden from sight, uniquely on this tiny planet, there was a cache of old books and scrolls, testimonies to human thought, that when opened the universe to us. 600 years on, of course, which is not a heartbeat in cosmic time. An amazing tale, certainly. We deal in disparagement and feel it proves we are freer of illusion than earlier generations were. We are, as we have always been, dangerous creatures, the enemies of our own happiness. that the only help we have ever found for this, the only amelioration, is in mutual reverence. God's grace comes to us unmerited, the theologians say. But the grace we could extend to one another, we consider it best to withhold in very many cases, presumptively, or in the absence of what we consider true or sufficient merit, we being more particular than God, or because few gracious acts, if they really deserve the name, would stand up to cost-benefit analysis. This is not the consequence of a new atheism or a systemic materialism that afflicts our age more than others. It is good old human meanness, which finds its terms and pretexts in every age. The best argument against human grandeur is the meagerness of our response to it, paradoxically enough. Then, how to recover the animating spirit of humanism? For one thing, it would help if we reclaimed, or simply borrowed, conceptual language that would allow us to acknowledge that some things are so brilliant they can be understood only as virtuosic acts of mind, thought in the pure enjoyment of itself, whether in making a poem or a scientific discovery, or just learning something it feels unaccountably good to know. There is an unworldliness in the experience, and in what it yields, that requires a larger understanding than our terse vocabularies of behavior and reward can capture. I have had students tell me that they had never heard the word beautiful applied to a piece of prose until they came to us at the workshop. Literature had been made a kind of data to illustrate, supposedly some graceless theory that stood apart from it, and that would be shed in a year or two and replaced by something post or neo, and in any case as gracelessly irrelevant to a work of language as whatever it displaced. I think this phenomenon is an effect of the utilitarian hostility to the humanities and to art, an attempt to repackage them, to give them some appearance of respectability. And yet, the beautiful persists, and so do eloquence and depth of thought. And they belong to all of us because they are the most pregnant evidence we can have of what is possible in us. Theology for This Moment. Honorary Lecture at the University of Lund, Sweden, May 26, 2016. Moses tells us, Jesus tells us, that we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Theology should give us some beginning of an idea of what it might mean to satisfy this commandment. A first step, I propose, would be a step back from all other disciplines and categories to invite a kind of awe at the entire phenomenon of being that embraces disciplines and categories and error and aspiration and everything they touch, that embraces thought and error and the work the mind does in its sleep. Jesus, again quoting Moses, says another commandment is like this one, that we love our neighbor as ourselves. Our neighbor, like ourselves, is objectively considered a creature born out of the tremendous, potent workings of the cosmos since, as they say, time began. We are also to love our enemies, which would surely mean taking on that most difficult and humbling realization that what they intend for evil, God, in the course of historic time, might well intend for good. We who live now have an overwhelming wealth of knowledge, for want of a better word, since we seem to have a great deal of difficulty absorbing the knowledge we amass. We actually have some capacity to describe the emergence of being and to read in very distant light some part of its vast pre-human life. We have some insight into the brilliance of the trillion lives within our lives, the microbes and molecules that create us and sustain us. Brilliant voices wait in our books to speak in our minds if we let them. There is a synthesis that is unique to theology, an acknowledgement that in sacred matters, in this theater of God's glory we share with those strangers, our neighbors, love means awe, and awe means love. A theology for our time would recover its old magisterial scale and confidence. It would address anything and any relation among things, and give the world a supple, inclusive language, far more adequate to what we know, less restricted in what we acknowledge, than any we have at present. For a long time, we have treated symptoms and ideologies as if their terms were at last sufficient to reality, as if, in excluding all heterogeneous assumptions, of religion particularly, they offered a truer representation of the world. These systems and ideologies, however we might embroider them, are in effect simple and simplifying. The invisible hand, the survival of the fittest, the dictatorship of the proletariat, superego, ego, and id. They are the antibiotics of the intellect, killing off a various ecology of reflection and experience in order to eliminate one or two troublesome ideas. What will replace that ecology is an open question, of course, and how potent, even to the point of pathology, the strains will be that survive the purge. My metaphor seems alarmist. I know that before we devoted ourselves to Darwinism and Marxism and Freudianism and capitalism, it was theology that was meant to inhibit thought, and that these successor monisms modeled their claims on the old claims of religious orthodoxy. We human beings can never make a truly fresh start. Nevertheless, a theology that would embrace rather than exclude would be a departure, not only from its own troublesome history, but from the narrowness and aridity of the secular thinking that has displaced it. Theology has always employed language of a kind now isolated in the precincts of religion, the beauty of holiness, grace and peace, phrases that evoke a particular experience, a synesthesia of thought and aesthetic response. From the point of view of objectivity as presently understood, beauty and holiness are excluded terms, and graces as well. The accepted means of establishing what is real cannot acknowledge them. Yet the celebration of holiness in every form of art has shaped civilizations. Granting human proneness to error, it is naive to imagine that it afflicts religion or anything else uniquely. It is the genius of science to have built this predisposition into its method, but this has not made science proof against the greater error involved in supposing that it is in fact the arbiter of reality. Christian theology, uniquely among the forms of Western thought, need not proceed by exclusion. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Christ was in the beginning with God, and without him, nothing was made that was made. The categorical blessing put on all that exists raises the problem of evil, certainly, but more important, it asserts a very broad, unconditional reality, a givenness that, in its fullness, reflects divine intent. It is the tendency of all the systems and schools I have named to raise questions about the origins and even the reality of human selfhood. Specifically, they challenge the moral self, that old wanderer through the trials and temptations of earthly life. Considering how they differ in their premises, it is striking how consistently they exclude personal agency, how deterministic they are. Yet we all experience the reality of moral choice continuously. A theology for our time would acknowledge this reality along with the entire complex of subjective experience, love, generosity, regret, and all their interactions, without a diminishing translation into veiled self-interest. It could create a conceptual space large enough to accommodate human dignity. I have read too much history to have any impulse to idealize the past. Great pity and very great respect are owed to all those generations who lived and died before us, not least because they, through war and plague and famine, conferred a precious heritage on us of art, language, music, and thought. And they conferred as well a tremendous burden of festering hostilities, vicious inequalities, and outright crimes that we have had no great success in understanding or ameliorating, that we have in fact compounded. Those of us who, by accident of birth, live long and enjoy relative peace and well-being, know well enough that humankind, beyond our borders, still struggles under its ancient burdens with their modern variants. How to make moral sense of this is a question that has been pondered earnestly for generations, yielding few unequivocal results. Modern hospitals quickly become pest houses in the absence of an infrastructure many countries find difficult to sustain. Traditional agriculture becomes a pool of cheap labor, exploited until cheaper labor is found elsewhere, and then abandoned to the effects of social and cultural disruption. Ragtag armies have ferocious weapons. The fluidity of modern societies and the chaos of failed states expedite human trafficking. The list is long, and we are implicated in it all in ways both obvious and subtle. I offer this very dark view of the world not only in order to pose the inevitable question, what is to be done, but also to respond to this question in terms that are now more or less precluded by the practical urgency of these problems. The response I propose is that we preserve as we can the heritage we have received, and that we enlarge and enrich it for the sake of coming generations. For a long time I assumed that this was simply a thing civilizations did, a practical definition of the word civilization. Now I see that wealthy countries are stepping away from ancient commitments, to humanist education, first of all. Humanists are the curators, in their own persons, of art, language, music, and thought. The argument everywhere now is that the purpose of education should be the training of workers for the future economy. So the variety of learning offered should be curtailed, and the richness of any student's education should be depleted to produce globally a Benthamite uniformity of aspiration and competence, and a subservience to uses not of his or her choosing. Max Weber's iron cage is slamming shut. Why this should be happening now, where it need not happen, in countries that could be called, by global standards, plenty rich enough? Why it is considered prudent to alienate, starve, even amputate institutions that are riches in themselves and creators of wealth of every kind, I do not know. But the impulse is at work all over the West, inducing us to sell our birthright in exchange for a reward far less certain and sustaining than that famous pot of lentils. In the West, it was theology and its consequences that built these great institutions, and the ebbing away of theology that has made them seem to many to be anomalies, anachronisms, and burdens as well. They were addressed to the many mysteries of human life on earth, and to the knowledge of God. Their mission would seem to have been the very height of impracticality if it were not so intrinsic a part of the emergence of the modern world. Theology and religion are not synonyms. Either can exist without the other, and either is diminished in the absence of the other. I can speak only of Christianity, of course. It would be a great presumption on my part to seem to generalize, farther at least than to say, that the highest intellectual and aesthetic achievements of every culture I know of seem to be associated with and addressed to their highest disciplines of religion, to their theology. The intentions that have created these institutions have made them stewards of defining cultural values, of conceptions of truth, and definitions by example of beauty. At this point, I should clarify my terms. By religion, I mean the individual and communal embrace of the particulars of a faith, or loyalty or affinity to it, that might not involve thoroughgoing belief in every article of its creed, that might be or seem to be almost exclusively aesthetic, ethical, or social, but is in any case important to one's self-definition. Religion has a public character that can distract even the pious from its origins and the human intuition that reality is rooted in a profounder matrix of being than sense and experience make known to us in the ordinary course of things. By theology, I mean the attempt to realize in some degree the vastness and the atmospheres of this matrix of being. Theology is the great architecture of thought and wonder that makes religious experience a house of many mansions, open to the soul's explorations, indeed made to invite and to accommodate them. One thing theology must do now is to reconsider and reject the kind of thinking that tends to devalue humankind, which is an influential tendency in modern culture, one that, not coincidentally, runs parallel to the decline of religion. This devaluing of the species, in effect, puts aside everything interesting about us as irrelevant to the question of our true nature. Objectively speaking, this is a remarkable project, itself a datum to be factored into a consideration of the many ways we are strange. A new theology should be open to recognizing our anomalous character, not least for the light it sheds on the precious and amazing lawfulness of the world, ourselves excepted. There is a sentence from a translation of an old English dream poem called Pearl that is especially pleasing to me. It says, "My soul by grace of God has fared, adventuring where marvels be." The speaker of the poem is describing a dream encounter with a lost infant daughter as a young woman in paradise. For me, the phrase has a more general application to life on earth. The sheer plenitude of things a mortal encounters is a marvel in itself. There is not only religion, never able to escape doubt, its shadow. There is also feigned religion as well, and religion that has slipped into utter derangement. There is not only lofty and glorious theology, but theology as grinding labor, engrossed in its own difficulty. Nothing human beings do or make is ever simply itself. No other species than ours could be called earnest. This is our response to special difficulties that attend our singular nature. We are unique in the effort we spend on the problems of defining our purposes and then accomplishing them, as the materials we put into them, facts, thought, words, slip and change while we work. No other species could be called ambitious, determined to reshape the world beyond the modest sufficiency that satisfies the niche-finding and nest-building generality of creatures. Error could be thought of as an extravagance parsimonious nature denies to migratory butterflies, but lavishes on us unstintingly. Out of this indeterminacy, this great latitude, and within it, we construct our minds and our civilizations. These are all things to be marveled at, certainly. There is a persistent tendency in modern thought to deny the anomalous character of the human presence in the world. No other creature could aspire to contriving a scheme that would reconcile itself fully to a present understanding of nature, especially one clever enough to be continuously changing its understanding of nature. We are never more unique than in our long struggle to deny our exceptionalism. Though it seems very unscientific to ignore logical contradictions, for example, these attempts to reason away the capacity to reason, this effort is commonly called science and is deferred to as science by much of society, including stewards of its religious culture. By my lights, this is altogether a phenomenon of that freedom to err that I have mentioned. A gravitationless space where ideas propagate and elaborate themselves free of the disciplines of reason properly so called. A major thrust of this school in recent years has been an argument against altruism, the capacity for generosity, for intentionally conferring benefit on another at cost to oneself. According to this theory, family enjoy what appears as generosity among its members because one instinctively protects those who share one's genetic makeup in the degree of their consanguinity. In other words, the benefit is to oneself because it ensures one's genetic immortality. In some degree, for a while, since endogamy is genetically unwise and exogamy overwhelms any particular genetic heritage in fairly short order. Of course, endogamy is practiced in some cultures and must have been the norm in a great many in pre-modern settings, where physical and social mobility were sharply limited. If the theory of genetic selfishness has merit, then these pools of self-similarity ought to yield communities brimming with generosity and mutual devotion. This seems not to have been the case, however. The old tendency of the crowned heads of Europe to marry their cousins provides a formidable counterexample. I will note here that the emotions whose reality is supposedly reasoned away by this school of thought are precisely those humankind are traditionally said to share with God. Christianity is, after all, the narrative of a cosmic altruism. God is love is an equation of meaningless terms if this interpretation of the emotions is granted. Certainly the age of marvels has not passed and will not so long as humankind roams the earth. This school of thought that would disallow the testimony of our emotional experience as evidence of the nature of our motives uses brilliant machines to make the point that in response to certain stimuli, certain regions of the brain light up, indicating increased activity. Among things in life that surprise, this would surely rank low. Nevertheless, it is offered as evidence to support the assertion that our emotions are not what we take them to be, that our feelings are a sort of ruse, a strategy to conceal our true selfish motives. Questions arise. What is this mysterious self that must be kept in the dark about its own baser impulses? How can it be fastidious about its ethical life when the impulses it conceals from itself are both natural and universal? This self looks to me like a rather robust survival of what was once called a soul, here offered as a fix for a theory that would otherwise be rejected out of hand. If its scruples are potent enough to shape the nervous system, how can they not be potent enough to shape behavior itself? All this is just an inelegant contrivance meant to excise humankind's moral qualities insofar as they cannot be reconciled to evolutionary theory. In another laboratory, perhaps associated with a mental hospital, the same brilliant machines scrutinize the brains of those who lack generosity and empathy, whom we call psychopaths, and who are taken to be organically injured or disabled, in any case abnormal, in that their behavior is unconstrained by these emotions the evolutionists consider to be actual enablers of self-interest. Is it more remarkable that we are all, by nature, psychopaths, or that these theorists do not read each other's journals? I mention all this simply to make the point that much influential thought is fundamentally incoherent, and no less influential for this fact. How we think about ourselves has everything to do with how we act toward one another. There are circumstances, we all know, in which ordinary people can become virtual psychopaths. If our feelings are meaningless, and our actions are in essence all of one kind, our passage through this veil of tears can't mean much. To the extent that anyone takes this kind of thinking seriously, humanism will be unsustainable as an idea. It is entirely possible that the desire to put down the burden of moral responsibility is the source of these theories, and that they are a product of cultural demand rather than a subversion of cultural values. Surely, flimsy as they are, no one would subscribe to them who was not predisposed to share their conclusions. People speak of disillusionment, but discrediting the moral worth of people in general, while discounting the capacity for empathy in oneself, minimizes the meaning of crime and liberates the criminal, as in the case of the psychopath. It opens the way to profounder disillusionment. Finally, mercilessness has always come easily to human societies. The penumbra of indeterminacy, of potential choice, that always hovers, can, as they say, quite suddenly decohere as brutality and resentment. To rationalize crude motives is one of the stranger projects of our period, in light of their continuing history of staggering cost. A theology for our time would reintegrate being. Our ways of understanding the world now, our systems and ideologies, have an authority for us that leads us to think of them as exhaustive accounts of reality, rather than, at best, as instruments of understanding suited to particular uses. Scientific method is brilliantly successful at doing what it is meant to do, observing and describing the physical universe. The uses made of it reflect moral choices that cannot be derived from it. Inoculation has saved many lives. When the practice was new, it was criticized on scientific grounds for burdening the race with lives that would better have been lost, eugenically speaking. What a human life is, how its value is to be reckoned, is a religious or philosophic question. Descartes, for his purposes, confirmed the truth content of his perceptions by assuring himself that God would not lie. A great deal is assumed here, notably that God sustains an active and honorable relation with human consciousness. This being the case, science is made possible by the intrinsic value of the individual in the divine scheme. Descartes need not establish this value by translating a theological statement into the terms of his method. To do so would be to undermine its foundation. Scientific method does not, at any given moment, provide an all-sufficient test for the reality of everything. It knows what it has the means to know. Dark matter, overwhelmingly the greater part of the mass of the universe, was inferred and discerned as part of a recent series of insights into the nature of the universe. It seems to be radically different from the kind of matter to which we are accustomed. It will remain dark incomprehensible, until science decides what kinds of questions will be fruitful, what kinds of observations will be possible. Science is incremental. A few decades ago, dark matter would have been impossible to conceive of. Science exploits accident and relishes surprise. The discovery that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, which was entirely unanticipated, opened the way to this radically new conception of the cosmos. Impressive as all this is, its greater meaning is that we can't know what we don't know, what we may never think to ask. It is an abuse of science to assume that the methods and terms of its understanding are ever sufficient or final. The understandings of human nature that have been proposed to us as scientific diminish us, even as science itself is amazed by our complexity, even as science itself is a demonstration of our brilliance. I notice that when archaeologists discover some anatomically pre-human creature, possibly a collateral ancestor, though probably not, their descriptions generally begin with a sentence containing the phrase, "surprisingly sophisticated." The rock and bone evidence of sophistication that remains after so many millennia indicates usually that they ornamented themselves, made tools, buried their dead, and cared for their aged and disabled. Why is the sophistication always a surprise? Presumably because a model of prehuman nature persists, unmodified by these discoveries. Again, I suppose the evolutionary model of human emergence discourages the thought that these creatures should share important traits with us, given the inadequacies of their prefrontal cortex. What can we do with the evidence of altruism? Surely the right word for tending the frail in absolutely primitive conditions. Would anyone suggest that they also were deceived as to the true selfish nature of their motives? We may have misunderstood many things because our own tale of origins cannot be reconciled with the fossil record. And this might be true because human evolution as we have imagined it has been one side in the antique battle between Darwinists and fundamentalists. I have absolutely nothing to propose that would make sense of the fossil record, which seems to be more complicated by the day, but I do find it beautiful that whatever these creatures were, ornament pleased them, and they could be gentle and provident. A marvelous light falls over the beginning of things and over us also, inclined as we are to pick up a shapely stone or a pretty shell. None of this is at all incompatible with a profound sacredness of being. Early Darwinism was virtually identical with racial theory, the races to be ranked, so it was thought, as stages in human development. Therefore, the sophistication of these non-humans continues to surprise. They are burdened by our prejudices. Surely it is much more scientific to relax the hold of old error and take it as true that the world is as wonderful in its mystery as any theology could hope to express, and that science, rather than impoverishing it of mystery, lavishes new marvels on us day by day. Granting its power, it is not clear to me that this or any method should be made to function as a metaphysics. We cannot say that the stars were arrayed to instruct us in the glory of God, to dispose our minds to wonder, to make us feel our finitude within an order of being for which millennia are more transient than a breath. This, for all we know, is the accidental consequence of the accidental emergence of the constellations, the fortuitous interaction of our unfathomable brains and senses with dazzling reality. In the beginning, it was a very remarkable atom that blossomed into a cosmos and is blossoming now in every thought anyone will think tomorrow in the accelerating rush of space toward what no one knows. We must step back and acknowledge that any accounts of the initial moments that make the event seem straightforward and comprehensible are deeply wrong. Nothing else could be true, considering what it has yielded. A new theology must begin from and always bear in mind the fact that there is something irreducibly thrilling about the universe, whatever account is made of it. I mention that primal particle, the mother of all accident, or so we are to assume, because it does integrate all being both potentially and in effect, now and through all futurity. Thought, language, emotion, culture, as surely as matter and energy, must derive from the initial moment that is now understood to have eventuated in the universe as we know it. What other origin could be proposed for them? If they evolved in some sense, they did so as they were prompted by the reality that contained them, one we can understand now as highly special. The complexity of ancient languages and of what we know of ancient thought discourages confidence that we are at the kind of straightforward advantage to them that evolution can be taken to imply. It would be theistic to say that the capacity for abstract thought, for example, was introduced into humankind by some external agent. This is not my style of theism, but others might find it an appropriate patch on a perceived unlikeness between the workings of the mind and what we call the material world. Let us say instead that this capacity must have arisen out of the transformation's potential in that first particle and realized over time consistently with these potentialities. Then, if this is the case, there is a profound intrinsic relationship among all forms of being. Within this universe there is no other or beyond, though there may be any number of modes of being intrinsic to it that we are not aware of. I have seen speculations that we feel the influence of other universes, and who can say finally that we do not? Proceeding on conventional assumptions, we can, as a thought experiment, run time backward until all phenomena are folded again into that first particle. I would expect accident to be invoked here, or the operations of the random. But the particle has made the rules. Quantum indeterminacy is mine, says the particle, and so are gravity and the speed of light. If we propose other universes, as many do now, we must assume differences among them that could well be radical. Our universe emerges consistently with constraints that we must assume are special to it, since slight difference would ramify through eons. So accident and randomness can only be thought of relative to our expectations. If they are hedged in by even this degree of particularity, then perhaps we need other names for and conceptions of the phenomena we take to be described by them. Quantum entanglement is haunting evidence that what we take to be true about space and time need not pertain even within our universe. How can any kind of determinism, even of accident and its consequences, be imagined if space and time are in any degree local and circumstantial? Perhaps they are a shared illusion, though anyone who has watched a cat calculate time and distance, then pounce, knows that they are not our illusion only. The meaning of all this for the new theology is that we have estranged ourselves from being by applying certain tests to determine the reality of things. Tests that are themselves implicitly naive or tendentious definitions of reality. Human consciousness has at least as great an impact on the planet as any force of nature, yet its existence is in doubt because science does not know how to describe it. If there were a lens that could capture the psychological or spiritual weather massing on this little globe, we all know it would show us very dark clouds. If climate change is worrisome, this brooding turn in our collective mood has the potential to exacerbate this and a thousand other problems, and to disgrace us as it does so. Therefore, in conclusion, a theology for our time should help us to know that being is indeed the theater of God's glory, and that within it we have a terrible privilege, a capacity for profound error and grave harm. We might venture an answer to God's question, "Where were you when I created?" We were there, potential and implicit, and by the grace of God, inevitable, more unstoppable than the sea, impervious as Leviathan, in that deep womb of time, almost hearing the sons of God when they shouted for joy. And we are here, your still-forming child, still opening our eyes on a reality whose astonishments we can never exhaust. The Sacred, the Human. The Truman G. Madsen Lecture on Eternal Man at the Wheatley Institution at Brigham Young University, September 17, 2016. Lately I have been reading Jonathan Edwards and reading about him for a lecture I will give in January. I have mentioned a number of times that many years ago my sense of reality was transformed by my reading a section of his treatise, The Great Christian Doctrine of Original Sin Defended, more specifically, a footnote about the nature of moonlight. I was assigned to read Edwards in an undergraduate philosophy course. His treatise rescued me from the small and dreary determinisms that were offered to us as insight into human nature and motivation than Freudianism and behaviorism. His argument is that there is nothing in being that accounts for its persisting as itself from moment to moment. The constancy of moonlight is not intrinsic to it, but is instead the effect of the continuous, continuously new reflection of sunlight. So with the apparent continuity of everything that exists, of existence itself. This is a perfectly sound insight from the point of view of physics. For Edwards, it meant that creation is constantly renewed as an act of God, who therefore remains free relative to his creation, within constraints he has set for himself, which preserve order, identity, and intelligibility. He is also, therefore, pervasively present and engrossed in it. How long has the so-called rationalist side of this old and very central controversy argued that reality is a mechanism of sorts whose own workings are fully sufficient to account for its origins and evolution, its past, present, and future? 3 centuries at a minimum. On this basis, religion has been marginalized as an unnecessary and implausible account of things that are properly within the boundless domain of science, including, emphatically, human nature and motivation. We know enough now about the infinitely small and the unfathomably vast, about the fine textures of being and the torrents of galaxies and constellations that pour through the universe, to be, it would seem, beyond our long fascination with the mechanical, and also beyond our antique habit of treating this anomalous biosphere as if it existed in isolation from the cosmos that contains it and of which it is made, or as if we could extrapolate from our quotidian knowledge of it to arrive at a fair description of reality as a whole. Determinism should be a little humbled by the fact that, for a century, causality itself has been seen to be a profound mystery, the old rules of sequence and locality not exhaustively descriptive. Yet the disciplines that treat of the human psyche are determinist as ever. These days we are believed by many to be locked into perpetual cost-benefit analysis, unconsciously guided by a calculus of self-interest somehow negotiated at the level of the genome. The, shall we say, biomechanics of all this are never described, of course. It has the apparent advantage, for its exponents, of marginalizing the mind, in fact anything that has ever been called the psyche, not to mention the soul. So did phrenology, eugenics, Marxianism, Freudianism, behaviorism. We have no capacity for meaningful choice, so they all tell us. Every one of these theories was powerful in its time, then passed into the kind of history we are always ready to forget. But the thing conserved out of all this, the thing always to be found within every new packaging, is a gimmick for asserting that we are not ourselves, that we are deceived, self-deceived, in the matter of our motives and experience. To annul the self as an intelligent moral actor is a terrible thing, objectively considered. It is literally the stuff of horror movies. Yet whatever form this notion takes in a given moment, the impulse is powerful and persuasive, and not just to sophomores. Having no more, perhaps less, empirical basis than belief in elves and fairies, a fairly recent appearance of this impulse under the term the selfish gene has enjoyed considerable authority. Its precursors have been embarrassed by scientific advances, or have simply gone out of style, in either case demonstrating their lack of empirical basis. The selfish gene, a theory that does not even nod to the complexity and fluidity of the genome, will no doubt hang around until some new costume is found to dress up the old idea. Behind the conception of reality as transparent and self-sustaining, and of the mind as a delusion that enables uncountenanced behavior whose sources are elsewhere, in the id, in the reptilian brain, in the genome, there are, at their origins and in their propagation, 2 intentions, which are undertaken as if to spread enlightenment, with something like the benign intent that moves Christians to send out missionaries. One purpose is to dispel belief in God, and the other is to dispel the soul as concept and as felt reality. I want to be very clear about 2 things before I proceed. First, In these strange times, I do not want to be taken to suggest a conspiracy, a cabal, a sinister other, or an intent on anyone's part to undermine all we hold dear, etc., etc. This strain of thought, this scientism, has been active and influential in Europe and Britain for centuries, among those very cultures with whom we feel special affinity. Second, I believe instead that I am describing a deep and long-standing tendency in human and Western consciousness, one felt as persuasive and as progressive and inevitable by many religious people. As irrational, ill-formed, and unlovely as I find these theories, I know that many people take precisely the same view of religion, and often, to our disgrace, they have very good grounds. I know excellent people who take these theories to be true and feel in good conscience that they owe them loyalty and belief because they are true. I know also that they are accepted as the only alternative on offer when the institutions of religion make themselves malicious or ridiculous. There are churches that uncritically accommodate themselves to these theories, so far as possible, and farther, as they accommodated themselves in earlier generations to eugenics and racial science. And then there is the large segment of the population who know nothing about religion at all, except what they hear from its very loudest voices, and who are therefore understandably secularists. So great is my respect for secular people that I wish they had a metaphysics worthy of them. I would be very interested to see a secularism based on contemporary science, though I grant the difficulty of deriving a metaphysics from anything as surpassingly dynamic and complex as the universe has proved to be at every scale, and as continuously open to reconception as our understanding of it must be. Of course, positivism forbade metaphysics as a language and as a mode of thought, which amounted to radically narrowing the questions it would or could address while jettisoning a great part of Western tradition. An experience-based model of reality, which was proposed to take tradition's place, was inevitably smaller and simpler, friendlier to thinking that did not aspire to engage with ultimate things, or even perhaps especially with penultimate things, notably the human mind or soul. Experience, as the word is used in this context, does not include acknowledged mental experience, reasoning, or intuition, certainly not aesthetic response. I must assume, however, that these theories I mention answer to the sense of reality, that is, to the mental experience, of their exponents, are intuitively plausible to them, affirmed inwardly. This response may be helped by the fact that what might seem most radical in them has actually been familiar for a very long time. To illustrate this point, I will quote a few passages from Religion and Science, published in 1935 by the Nobel Prize winner Bertrand Russell. His prize was in literature, but he speaks very confidently for science, a latitude I must grant him, since I do the same sort of thing. Russell says that, though psychology is still at an early stage of development, something has been achieved, and much ancient error has been discarded. Much of this ancient error was associated with theology, either as cause or as effect. He follows the idea of the soul through Plato, Descartes, Kant, Hegel, and concludes that, within the realm of what can be known, there is no room for the conception of substance, or for its modification in the form of subject and object. The primary facts which we can observe have no such dualism, and give no reason for regarding either things or persons as anything but collections of phenomena. He says that psychology, in like manner, is finding it necessary to give up such concepts as perception and consciousness, because it is found that they are incapable of precision. Following the implications of science as he understands it, he offers this. So long as it could be supposed that one perceives things in the outer world, one could say that, in perception, one was conscious of them. Now we can only say that we react to stimuli, and so do stones, though the stimuli to which they react are fewer. So far, therefore, as external perception is concerned, the difference between us and a stone is only one of degree. Then this. Memory, it may be said, is something distinctively mental, but this again may be denied. Memory is a form of habit, and habit is characteristic of nervous tissue, though it may occur elsewhere, for example, in a roll of paper which rolls itself up again if it is unwound. And finally, For science, there does not seem to be such an entity as the soul or self. This is the always breaking news, always newly arrived at, always a conclusion compelled by the